com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Victory or Holocaust? According to our guests tonight, those are the choices America faces in the war on terror. Richard Perle and David Frum are two highly placed hardliners, hawks that circle on lofty currents in the Bush administration. Perle is former chairman of the Defense Policy Board. Frum is a former speechwriter for President Bush. Both men were outspoken proponents of the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. The dust of that invasion is not yet settled. The blood still flows, but Perle and Frum fear American resolve is flagging just when it should be firing up for more. So these two tough-talking neocons have published an aggressive plan which, they say, can win the war on terror. A manual they've titled An End to Evil. Topple governments in Syria and Iran, blockade North Korea, abandon the idea of a Palestinian state, put France in its place, and put a pro-U.S. spine back into the U.N. It's a clear, hard line that puts a muscular U.S. military front and center globally for as long as it takes. Frum and Perle say they believe that in a new and dangerous world, the American public instinctively senses that, quote, the toughest line is the safest line. Tonight on Point, Richard Perle, David Frum, and the toughest line. Do you buy it? Is a hard line the best line, the only line to take in the war on terror? Do you believe America is facing a choice between victory and Holocaust? Are you ready to roll out the big guns with Richard Perle and David Frum? Is there another way? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The new book is An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. Its authors join me now from Washington. Richard Perle is former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and former chairman of the Bush Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. Good evening and welcome, Richard Perle.
Good evening.
And David Frum is former special assistant and speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Good evening and welcome, David Frum.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Richard Perle, to you first, if I may. The book starts right out saying that despite everything that's gone on in Afghanistan and in Iraq and with capture of al-Qaeda leaders, you feel that the momentum of the war on terror is dangerously flagging. What are the signs of that in your eyes?
Well, one sign is the near consensus among the Democratic candidates that we either shouldn't be pursuing this vigorously or we've been diverted from our course, that if only we had stuck to chasing al-Qaeda, everything would be fine. And that misses the point about this war.
But the Democrats are not in power. The Republicans are, and maybe for another 4 years. Is it just nine candidates at their podiums that have you worried?
I think the administration understands clearly that it has to regard this war for what it is, a long-term and intensely ideological struggle against the successor, in a sense, to Nazism and communism, which is now radical Islam. Fringe, to be sure, but nevertheless very powerful.
But are you suggesting, Richard Perle, that there's a flagging will to fight this war even in the Bush administration, even in the Pentagon, the White House?
No, I think the administration is quite solid on this. There is, however, a great reluctance in the bureaucracy to make the changes necessary to reconstruct the institutions that are going to have to fight this war because they were built for another purpose.
David Frum, maybe it doesn't go there, but your book and your recent writing with Richard Perle outline and name names among administration members, including Secretary of State Colin Powell, described as a soft liner. Do you see a soft line running through the Bush administration?
There's that temptation. Look, Secretary Powell is a fine man and a distinguished public servant. And, I mean, no one is questioning his commitment to the security of the country, but he is at the top of an institution, the State Department, which has probably more than any institution in Washington, a coherent institutional point of view. And that point of view has been inimical to waging this war as effectively as it ought to be. I mean, really, to be at this point, this late date, saying we can see the possibility of dialogue with the Iranian mullahs, people who have lied to the United States again and again.
And this is just in the last week or so. This is just in the last week or so.
What are we going to have a dialogue with them about? Why are we going to have a dialogue about the nuclear production facilities that they deceived us about until recently? And the only reason we know they have the extensive nuclear facilities that we now know they have is because brave Iranian dissidents smuggled out documents to expose the lies of the regime. you know, I think just as a matter of self-respect, when a regime lies to us as much as Iran does, we ought to at least insist on fresh lies rather than the same old lie over and over again.
All right, Richard Pearl, take us in then to your prescription. And we're listening carefully here. We remember speaking with you before the war in Iraq and your warnings about weapons of mass destruction, the kind of immutable logic of needing to go in for those. We haven't seen them yet. But now you're looking forward from this point. And what's the sequence of steps that you see as important to maintaining U.S. security?
Well, I believe there are a number of governmental reforms that are necessary. We have a military establishment that was built to contend with the Soviet Union in the center of Europe. That's no longer our problem. The problem today is terrorist activity, which can take place entirely within the confines of a country until an attack is launched, and then it's too late. We need to rebuild the Central Intelligence Agency, whose record on matters related to radical Islam is appallingly weak. They missed the Shah of Iran. They missed Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. They lack the depth of knowledge of language, culture, history that is necessary to contend with this new set of threats. The United Nations, in which a great many people repose much too much confidence, was never designed to deal with terrorism. It was designed to deal with aggression across national borders. We have to change the way the UN regards our effort to defend ourselves, and so on.
The so on is pretty big here, and at the end of it, David Frum, you all describe a choice between victory and Holocaust. We're going to look at the so on, but how does it boil down in your mind to victory or Holocaust? Is there really nothing in between, and is what you're describing, toppling governments here, there, and there, going after North Korea, so on and so on, are you calling for a kind of American global domination? Is that victory?
Well, there are a lot of questions you ask. Let's just begin with the question about what does Holocaust mean? You have to look at a war, not from the point of view of what you wish the realities were or what you wish your choices were, but what your enemies intend to do. There are tens of thousands of old nuclear warheads at large in the former Soviet Union. There's a lot – nuclear technology is increasingly accessible. There's a lot of nuclear material. There may be the possibility of nuclear warheads or nuclear technology in North Korea that could be sold. Now, if people like al-Qaeda were to get their hands on these terrible, terrible weapons, what on earth do you suppose they would do with them? Before 9/11, it was kind of the conventional wisdom in the security system in Washington that, you know, terrorists might kill 10 or 20 or 40 or 100 people to draw attention to their cause, but since they wanted the sympathy of the world, they would never kill all that many. Well, al-Qaeda on 9/11 killed in one day more people than the Irish Republican Army has killed in 30 years. And I think that should prove the point that al-Qaeda and organizations like it would institute, if they could get their hands on the wherewithal, mass murder on a scale that would involve 10,000, 100,000, maybe more casualties. And that is exactly the kind of Holocaust we're worried about.
But clearly now, there's a big spectrum of views about how to go at that problem. You guys are defining one end of it, and you're proudly defining that end of it, but it is one end of it.
I'll agree. Even if we're going to disagree about how to go about it, let us at least agree on what the stakes are. The stakes are that there are terrorist organizations backed by powerful regimes in the Middle East, supported, unfortunately, by the public opinion of a substantial minority of opinion in the Middle East, that is willing to inflict mega death on the United States, on Western Europe, on American allies around the world. So that is the Holocaust that we're worried about. And when we say victory, what we mean is the defeat and destruction of such organizations so that Americans and Western Europeans and their friends do not have to live with the thought that today, when I go downtown or take the subway, today might be the day that the dirty bomb goes off in downtown Washington. Today might be the day that they release these spores in central New York, and the day that so many people suffer and die.
Richard Pearl, let me ask you, with just that logic, and we heard it from you before the Iraq War, are you at all abashed that the United States went in and did not find the weapons that were warned of, the weapons that you used to kind of close that circle of logic that demanded this kind of forceful military approach to Baghdad?
No, not at all. Decisions that have to be made about how to react to threats based on intelligence entail the management of risk. All of the evidence pointed to stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, and in particular, the fact that the United Nations had documented the creation of these weapons, and Saddam Hussein refused to supply information that would permit us to confirm that they had been destroyed. So what assumption would a reasonable person make under those circumstances? We had seen Saddam organize thousands of people whose mission was to hide things. We heard conversations in which people were told to move things before inspectors could arrive. And we had the inventory that came not from our own intelligence, but from the United Nations.
But given that they weren't finally
there...
But does it matter when we hear you and David Frum describing the Holocaust, the picture of a dirty bomb or nuclear weapons in terrorist hands as the rationale for a kind of a global military forward push by the United States? Is the logic weak? If the weapons didn't show up this time, if there are other ways that could be pursued, does it suggest that is the lesson of Iraq? Maybe we should look at those other ways.
Well, that, if I may say so, really isn't the issue that it seemed to me you were getting at. You seem to be suggesting that because stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction were not found, we should disregard warnings about possible dirty bombs. And I think that would be a fatal, illogical leap.
And still it remains, how do we go at these? There's a kind of big
Well,
checklist.
That's another matter. We can certainly debate whether the soft line or the hard line is the most appropriate way to contain the threat. But I think it is would be a grave mistake to suggest that we can ignore these threats because we didn't find weapons of mass destruction.
Colin Powell, I guess you define as the biggest administration voice of the soft line. What's your critique of that line, of the multilateral path, of the let's reach out and talk, of let's not go to war so often to solve this problem, Richard Pearl?
Well, first of all, I don't think that Colin Powell is the principal spokesman for that.
Within the Bush administration?
No, he's quite circumspect about what he says. Armitage would be a better candidate for that position.
Well, fair enough, though. Colin Powell's been writing lately just in Foreign Affairs, talking about the need for allies and a multilateral approach. But place it where you will. What's your critique of that approach?
Allies and multilateralism are fine when they're available to us. The critique is very simple and straightforward. We can't always have allies who are prepared to take the risks that we think we have to take. We couldn't persuade the French, who had a different set of interests, for example. So the United Nations was not there to support us. We couldn't persuade the Germans because Chancellor Schroeder was running for re-election. Can we subordinate our defense, our security, to the whims or electoral necessity or attitude of a German or a French leader? I think not.
May I jump in?
David Frum, please.
There's a old cruel old joke about economists, that an economist is somebody who, when he's stranded on a desert island with a can of tinned food, solves his problem by saying, assume a can opener. Well, our critique of the softliners is that their foreign policy amounts to saying, assume a can opener. So when they're confronted with a problem like, wouldn't it be great if we had some allies with us in Iraq, they say, assume some allies. If you say, look, we see these terrible situations in Central Africa and Western Africa, wouldn't it be great if there were an effective international organization to deal with them? Their response is, well, assume you do. But assumptions aren't policy. You know, when you introduced us as two, I don't know that I got all the adjectives, all the adverbs, but
arch-conservative,
arch-hardline, ultra-conservative, neoconservative.
I haven't heard you guys walk away from that much. I mean, that is where you plant your flag,
I'm about to. It was done before the show came on. Mm-hmm. We're polite, too. But these epithets are used to suggest that there's some kind of element of ideology and willfulness.
Are they epithets in your case? I mean, aren't you describe softliners.
Well,
aren't you the other end of the...
Arch, unless you mean it in the sense of amusingly ironic, is usually an epithet. The idea behind terms like this is to suggest there's some kind of ideological blindness. But what we are arguing in our book, when we put forward these very specific recommendations about what to do, is to say, look, deal with the world as it is. And the softliners who tell us, well, we should invite the United Nations to take over responsibility for Iraq, they are not dealing with the world as it is, because that's not the kind of the United Nations, when it came to Iraq, ran away at the first breath of danger.
David Frum, Richard Pearl, stand by. In the spectrum, it sounds hardline to me. Listeners, you decide. We're talking tonight with Richard Perle and David Frum about their plan to end evil globally with U.S. might. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to take the hard line? Is it time to topple governments in Iran and Syria, to blockade North Korea, to take apart the U.N. if necessary? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with conservative global warriors Richard Perle and David Frum about their plan to end evil globally with U.S. might. Their new book is An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the aggressive global application of U.S. military might the only realistic way to stop terrorism? Are the alternatives, in Perle and Frum's words, victory or holocaust? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is calling from Hollis, New Hampshire. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm nearly dying of laughter here from these guys. I really am. I'm glad that the Prince of Darkness, Mr. Perle, has come out and confirmed that this administration concurs with his global outlook at world domination. I say victory or holocaust. You follow what those guys are saying, we've got holocaust.
And why, Paula? They're saying, you know, if you don't, there's a nuclear threat out there. There's a terrorist threat out there.
That's a load of bull.
Well, there was 9/11.
What?
Well, there was 9/11.
Yeah, right. And so they attack Iraq, and they're attacking Iran, and they're letting North Korea make nukes over there. Whoopee-doo. And why didn't the world go with us? It was because, if you might remember from the Carnegie Endowment report just came
yesterday.
Out, and the next one
mm-hmm.
is coming out, and what's his name, Kay, or whoever he is, the inspector in charge who may not even return because there's nothing to find over there. The whole bloody thing was a lie. This guy is a paranoid. He sees commies under his bed. Only these commies wear turbans. I do not subscribe to it, and I thank God he's just clarified this administration stance on it because that was just even more confirms that I would never, ever vote them back, ever. I didn't vote them in the first place, but, you know.
Paul, we've got it. Richard Perle.
Counting on
Richard
your vote.
Perle. Yeah, I suppose they're not. But how do you deal with the charge, Richard Perle, that there's a paranoia here that doesn't leave room to see opportunities beyond the kind of military push?
Well, first of all, there's a distinction to be made, an essential distinction between the assessment of the threat and how you go about solving it. And your caller seems not to distinguish between the two issues because she sees that there is no threat. Now, we did have September 11. Most Americans noticed that. Does she think that there's no danger of another terrorist attack? She talked about North Korea. Is she ready to deal with North Korea to prevent them from acquiring and possibly distributing nuclear weapons? Does she think there is no danger? Or does she not like the recommendations we make for how to cope with that danger?
Paula, do you want to respond to that?
You bet I do. Well, first of all, as far as North Korea goes, I wouldn't have ignored it so long while they're reprocessing rods and things like that. I wouldn't have not talked to them because they were some kind of horrible regime, which is what this administration did, number one. Number two, as far as 9/11 goes, I would try to correct some of the misplaced American foreign policy that is causing it by this crazy support over and above any kind of humanity, fairness, anything in Israel. This is another story.
Crazy support where? What do you mean there, Paula?
Pardon me?
Crazy support for what?
For Israel.
I see.
As it is. And I am not anti-Semitic, huh?
Well,
but
this amounts to
what's going on. I mean,
to an argument that 9/11 was justified by American policy, and I think that's just complete nonsense, complete rubbish. And if that is the issue on which you hope to remove the Republican administration, you're in for a rude shock.
But we feel the skepticism there, loud and clear, Paula, and thanks for your call. David Frum, I want to take this a bit out of the hypothetical and get down to some of the sort of very clear ingredients that you see in an answer to terrorism. Can you walk us through those? Let's start with Syria and Iran. In your view, what's required there?
Well, in the case of Iran, we have some very important friends and allies. We were talking about multilateralism before, and they are the population of Iran. This is a regime in Iran that has not only sponsored terrorism against the United States, not only even now is sheltering much of the senior leadership of al-Qaeda and members even of bin Laden's family. It's also a regime that has impoverished its country to really a shocking degree when the regime took power, Iran enjoyed a standard of living a little below that of Portugal. Today, Iran has a standard of living roughly equivalent to that of the Gaza Strip, very high unemployment.
So you're saying the regime has to go. How would you get them out? Invasion?
No, what I'm saying is that the population is coming out into the streets in the hundreds of thousands to protest, often, ironically enough, carrying American flags.
But it's more than leaving it up to them that you're prescribing. I mean, throughout,
no,
you're
we have
saying
to help them.
Yeah,
look,
exactly. You're saying let's help throughout, and you're saying let's help. And as I read it, more or less as aggressive a form as required to get the job done.
Well,
what does that mean?
We've lived through one precedent, one parallel is what happened in Poland in the 1980s, where you had a desperately unpopular repressive government hated by its own people. What did we do for the Poles? We provided the Polish resistance with the wherewithal to be effective, to keep in touch with communications equipment, with money, with training. We did something even more important, which is we kept track of the names and whereabouts of members of the Polish resistance so that the regime knew that it couldn't make them disappear without enormous consequence.
So is that in Iran, or would you be willing to see U.S. troops go there to see the CIA go into Iran? How far should the United States be prepared to go to prosecute regime change in Iran?
But U.S. troops would not be helpful or necessary in the case of Iran. In the case of Iran, we have these incredibly powerful allies in the population. We have to help that population to liberate itself.
So that's
here. One of the things we are very explicit about in the final chapter of Anent Evil is that we are not calling, in fact, for a regime of American global rule. That the vision that motivates us is the vision of a world in which people are liberated to enjoy the freedoms that Americans take for granted in our own country.
But you're not at all shy about saying use the U.S. military when necessary, in your view, to help get that job done.
Well, as people from France to Taiwan can tell you, it has been true for the history of the 20th century that democracy has not always happened spontaneously and has often required the help and protection of American military power against anti-democrats. That's the reason that, and not Israel, was the reason that we were attacked on 9/11, because American military power, American power, American existence has been as it was in 1917, as it was in 1941, as it was in 1947, has always been the principal obstacle in the way of despots and tyrants.
Richard Perle, in Syria and North Korea, concretely, what steps should the United States be prepared to take to solve those situations as you see them?
Well, I think we're attempting the right initial course with respect to North Korea. And by the way, contrary to what your previous caller said, we entered into an agreement with the North Koreans in 1994.
In the 90s, but you're calling for a sort of Cuba-style blockade now.
She seemed to suggest we weren't talking to them. We were sending them money, fuel.
Up until the Bush administration, that stopped. There's a new policy.
No, until we caught them cheating on the agreement, until we found that having promised to end the program, they had another secret program.
Would you blockade? Would you send troops in to go after the potential nuclear weapons there?
I think we have started by trying to mobilize countries that have a lot of influence, like China, to persuade the North Koreans to abandon their program. I hope that works. If it doesn't work, we'll have to move to a next level.
And including those steps as outlined in your book. What about Syria?
Including a blockade so that if they do produce nuclear weapons, they can't hand them over to terrorists who might use them against us. And ultimately, if we are unsuccessful with those measures, we certainly can't rule out the use of force.
Syria. There was discussion of hot pursuit right after the war. Douglas Feith was reined in on that, as I understand. But should U.S. troops be pressing on Damascus?
No, and we're not recommending that U.S. troops press in on Damascus. I think that the Syrians are beginning to get the message, just as Muammar Gaddafi got the message. And the message is very clear. If you pose a threat to the United States, the United States is, A, going to notice it, and, B, will take some action in response. That was not the pattern of the previous decade, and that's one of the reasons why we wound up attacked as we were on September 11th.
Should the U.S. be prepared to use military force if necessary to see regime change in Damascus?
Well, you make that an easy question to answer when you use the phrase, if necessary. If we saw the Syrians on the verge of weapons of mass destruction and had no confidence that we could contain that threat by any other means, we should not rule out the use of force.
Joe is calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Joe.
I had a question. The previous caller, I certainly felt that you were relatively civil given the tone of voice she was using. But she did make a point at the end that you dismissed that I just like to get your take on. And that is that, you know, forget about the, you know, justification for September 11th. Obviously, that was an act that was heinous and unjustified in any situation. But the people that fly planes into buildings and blow themselves up with bombs don't come from a vacuum. There's something in the background of these people, in the culture, the society. They're not, you know, well-fed and happy people. There's something wrong there.
Something wrong? Are you pointing at Islam, Joe, or where's your finger coming down?
No, I'm saying there's something wrong with regard to poverty, to maybe a lack of education. Typically, I mean, these people are coming out of either dire situations or they're seeing dire situations in other people in their cultures.
So where are you taking this here? What's your question, Joe?
Well, my question is, does this have a component to your approach here and your policy to try to stem the source of people willing to blow themselves up to kill others and to you know, take some kind of tact, even in addition to any military actions, to try to change the circumstances on the ground so that you're not producing so many terrorists, so many people willing to die?
Let us pick it up, Joe, and thanks for your call. David Frum, how do you define the source?
I think Joe is right. One of the things we do argue is, yes, you have to understand the fundamental causes of this problem and understand that terrorists have political motives. Unfortunately, where Joe goes astray is it's very common for Americans when they see somebody do a terrible thing to say, people are so good that if somebody does a terrible thing, it must be because somebody else has done a terrible thing to him. So if he's done these things, he must be poor, he must be uneducated. But we know a great deal about the biographies of the 19 hijackers. We know a great deal about the biography of Osama bin Laden. And these are not poor people. These are very wealthy and privileged people. In fact, one of the things that seems to be motivating them is the fear that the changes in the region that are being introduced by the example of the United States, the images they see on their satellite dishes, these are profoundly threatening to privileges that they have and would like to.
They here, David Frum?
The Islamic extremists in the Middle East are not the poorest of the poor by any means. They are often very privileged people who are looking for even more power over their leaders.
And you paint this group very clearly as the new axis that the United States should be aimed against. No bones about it. And you say the roots of Muslim rage are to be found in Islam itself. Does your prescription...
Exactly. That's just not true. It's exactly the opposite.
I'm sorry. I'm quoting from your book. The roots of Muslim rage are to be found in Islam itself.
The roots of Muslim... I think what we say is that the roots of Muslim rage are to be found in the failures of Islamic societies.
Well, page 48, also, Islam itself.
I think you may then be slicing off parts of the paragraph, because one of the things we also say is that Muslims who want democratic societies, who want freedom, can find in their own traditions plenty of examples and plenty of justifications, and we even quote some of them. Quranic passages. There is a tradition in Islam that is available for people who want democracy to use. You can have an Islam with Islamic cultural characteristics consistent with Islamic faith that is also democratic.
But is there a fundamental problem with Islam?
If I can just finish before you get so excited, while that's possible, that we have to understand that there are these terrible ideologies that do respond to the failures of these societies to modernize adequately, in many ways analogous to what happened in Central Europe and in Eastern Europe in the 1930s and 1940s, when they too met with reverses and people turned to extremist ideologies. But it is not what we need to do is to grapple with these ideological problems, these ideological expressions, and offer coherent alternatives, not to say we're going to stop being less ourselves, we're going to turn off, we're going to stop broadcasting our messages to the world, that we're going to tell American women they have to cover their faces lest they offend people. We are going to say we're going to be ourselves and we're going to help other societies to find that with consistent with their cultural traditions, they can have freedom too.
But I'm asking you whether this approach locks the United States into a kind of death struggle with Islam beyond the extremist Islam that you describe. You say, here's the full context, Middle Eastern terrorism may have seized on the United States as its target, but the roots of Muslim rage are to be found in Islam itself. Is there a danger here that this approach creates a kind of death struggle, that one of these elements in your victory or Holocaust formula has to go?
Well, I certainly don't think it locks us in a death struggle. And to say that the roots are in Islam itself in this context is to say that the roots are in an extremist version of Islam, which we say repeatedly throughout the book, an extremist fringe sentiment that has been fueled by enormous amounts, billions and tens of billions, coming from the Saudis and elsewhere in the Gulf, that have that has created institutions of hatred and holy war around the world. That's where the problem lies. And to suggest that our policies, changes in our policies, would fundamentally affect the vision of people who want to impose an Islamic extremist government on the whole world, I think really misses the point.
James is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, James, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I'd like to challenge the author's assertion that military might somehow be associated with America and American security. And I want to relay a brief vignette that came recently when I was speaking with a man in Cairo. And this man pointed out that under the Clinton administration, the sort of inclusive foreign policy of the Clinton administration made it seem to him and his countrymen that the U.S. was making friends every day. And he said that the more recent policies under the Bush administration, and the ones that I think are fairly well advocated by the authors, instead alienated the countries that used to be American allies. So I think that September 11th was a terrible tragedy that was perpetrated on the 3,500 or so victims. But I think that, you know, that certainly is a tragedy, but what maybe is a greater tragedy is the very tangible assault on American civil liberties that the Bush administration and that these policies and the Patriot Act and Patriot Act 2.
Jim, let me take it right there because we're coming up to a break. Richard Pearl, if we could hold it to the first part of Jim's question, which was...
No, you'd better take the second
part. We'll
the
come
second
to that.
Part
but
the more astonishing.
Well, let's get
the
first...
Part is
excuse
incredible.
Me, excuse
man,
me, David. From, we'll wait on that for a moment.
The Patriot Act is worse than 9/11?
Yeah, hang on, please.
You're going to let that go?
For the moment, I am, because the core question was... do you risk alienating more people than you bring around to the American path by this American approach? Richard Pearl, what about that calculus? How do you see it?
Well, I don't know that we can take the view that if our necessary self-defense is going to alienate someone, we mustn't engage in that defense. If we know that there is a demonstrable threat, a military threat, a threat possibly... to be implemented by suicidal maniacs, do we decide we can't respond to that because we might alienate somebody?
When there's that clear and present danger, when it's a broader global security issue, isn't there ultimately a kind of trade-off here?
Well, if there is a trade-off, I don't think we have much choice but to act in the first instance to protect our citizens and worry about alienating people later. You can't let the bomb fall because you were unwilling to take action to stop it.
Richard Pearl, David Frum, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with conservative hardliners Richard Pearl and David Frum about their plan to end evil globally with U.S. might. The book, name of their book is An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this the realistic view? Is this what it's really going to take? Move away from all the soft line, pick up this hard line, and do it right. Does this sound like a recipe for world peace and democracy, or a lot of war? And what's the fundamental view of the world you hear in the Pearl Frum plan? You could join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Frum, you were concerned about our caller's comment there on, what was it, civil liberties after 9/11.
Right.
And I'm not sure I heard him say that the Patriot Act was worse than 9/11, but he was concerned about what's happened.
Much more dangerous. He said it was that 9/11 was a tragedy, but a much greater tragedy was the attack on civil liberties represented by the Patriot Act.
Well, of course, if you assume that that means a long-term deep erosion of civil liberties, maybe you could begin to talk about that. But maybe it's a platform.
I don't know if the caller is still on the line.
He is not.
If he is, I would bet him a box of donuts that he could not name a single provision of the Patriot Act, because if he had any acquaintance with what was in it, I think he would have to be ashamed of himself. The Patriot Act says things like the following. It says, before the Patriot Act, if you wanted to wiretap somebody's telephones, which the United States government has done since the invention of telephones with warrants, that you needed to get a separate wiretap for every phone number that person had. The Patriot Act said, if you want to wiretap somebody and you get a warrant, you need one warrant for that person. If he changes his phone number, you don't need to go get a new warrant. It brought the wiretapping of telephones into the age of multiple handsets.
David Frum, we take your point on that, but you understand very well the kind of deep concern and value that Americans put on civil liberties, and you understand, if you've seen, the fear that those could be eroded in a war on terror. We've talked about your prescriptions.
But I also understand, yes, and what is really important is that people who do not want to wage this war for other reasons have inflamed completely groundless fears about the danger to civil liberties.
But I want to look specifically at your domestic program.
Things. I mean, the idea that the murder of 3,000 people is a lesser tragedy than the fact that you can now get one search warrant for one person and not one for each of his phone numbers. That to have arrived at that point where an intelligent person, as that caller clearly was, a well-spoken person, could believe such a thing indicates, I think, exactly the kind of crisis of confidence and morale and maybe even understanding.
And, you know, I'm sorry he's not here to say it, but I'm quite sure that it's not a matter of telephone numbers that he had in mind. It's a deeper concern about civil liberties that anybody going into a war who's thinking about it ought to be concerned about, because wartime, of course, can and has threatened civil liberties. Let's look at the domestic elements of your program for a moment. It's aggressive abroad. What are the main elements abroad? You want at home? You want to restructure the FBI, and what else?
Well, the restructuring of the FBI is very important. The FBI is a police force, and they are very good at dealing with things like embezzling and bank robbery and kidnapping. But they're not a counter-terrorist force, and they've been spectacularly unsuccessful at it. They have very few, for example, Arabic speakers on their payroll. And the congressional report into what happened in 9/11 documents case after case where the FBI simply didn't follow leads, where messages were not shunted back and forth between offices, because as one of the critics of the FBI said, that the FBI didn't have the mission.
So get them out of the anti-terror business, and who fills the vacuum?
We need to create a new organization that is not a police force, that doesn't prosecute cases, doesn't make arrests, isn't governed by lawyers, that is an intelligence gathering operation whose mission is to stop terrorist acts rather than to make terrorist arrests. That's one thing we need. Another thing we need is to take action against the growing infrastructure of extremism that has been funded by Saudi money inside the United States. You know, right now, if you operate an institution, a school, for example, that practices racial segregation, you're free to do that. It's a free country, but you don't get tax deductions and you have to pay your property taxes. But if you operate a school that teaches religious hatred, you can become a charitable institution. We suggest that the rules for the teaching of religious incitement ought to be the same as the rules for the practice of racial segregation.
And you'd apply that to all religions or Islam in particular?
Well, that should be true of all religions, obviously. But where this is a growing danger, and not just a where this is a growing danger and a serious concern, is with some of the Islamic academies, and we document in the book how important institutions, not fringe places out in the countryside somewhere, but the pride and cream of these academies, funded usually by foreign money, are teaching, and not just prejudice, but actual incitement. This is an extreme danger, and as I said, they're free to do it, but they shouldn't be free to do it with a tax deduction. We should treat such schools the way we treat Bob Jones Academy.
And Richard Perle, in Washington at the CIA, you would change the mission there as well. How would you do that?
Well, I think the CIA, unfortunately, has an appalling record when it comes to understanding the region and anticipating events in the Middle East and more broadly in the Islamic world. I have inquired and so far have been unable to find any indication that at any point over the dozen or so years just past, during which Saudi funding of extremist institutions around the world was taking place, that the president was briefed by the CIA and alerted to the danger that this ultimately would pose. One of your earlier callers mm-hmm. was speculating on the underlying causes, the origins of the hatred that leads people to undertake suicidal attacks to kill others. A lot of this is taught. It's taught in madrasas in Pakistan and elsewhere.
Are you suggesting a role for the CIA somehow in pushing back against that, or do you want to get the CIA out of active operations and strictly into analysis? What's the future role in your view?
Well, I think there is a need for analysis. There is also a need for operational capability, and unfortunately, the CIA on both counts comes up very short. One of the reasons, I believe, is that the communities there on the operational and analytical side that have had it wrong for so long have been essentially unchanged. Any private business that compiled such an appalling record would have seen personnel changes.
And you say you want to turn it over with each new administration, let more political appointees come in to mix things up.
No, the problem isn't political appointees, and as a matter of fact, the current head of the CIA was appointed by his predecessor.
But I thought that was part of your recommendation, is not to keep it in the hands of lifers, but to have more fresh blood coming in with new administrations.
Well, fresh blood, to be sure, because the blood that is there now just isn't doing it.
So let's mix it up. Rob is calling from Boston. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, it sounds like these guys like a lot of fresh blood. But I know there's so many things that have probably been said since I've been waiting here. But if we just get back, not to talk about individuals, particular individuals or particular belief systems
okay.
being good or bad, but this concept of evil that they have, it sounds like this very finite thing. And I'm thinking it's less that, if anything, that if they're talking about this concept of evil, and more like something like the ancient, that mythological creature, the Hydra. You cut off one head and three more come about. Their notion sounds like this mysterious algorithm. It's a very mathematical, very materialist based, and I'm just trying to understand, do they know what ideology is? They're talking about trying to figure out these ideologies. So the ideology of consumption is very powerful and very destructive, and it doesn't always make people happy. So I'm just trying to get a sense then, if they're doing science, and it sounds like they're trying to be empiricists here, what if they go and do all of this work, collect all of this data, and what if it points back to something, in this direction? I know it's similar to what other people have been critiquing these guys about.
Rob, let us pick it up. We've got the picture. Richard Pearl, is that you?
Well, I'm afraid I don't have the picture. I don't understand the question.
I guess the question is evil something that can be framed and then destroyed? An End to Evil is it's a very bold title on the book. We've had guests on the show say, look, you can't end evil. Evil runs through human nature. We have elements of it even in ourselves. Exactly how are you framing it? When do you know when you've achieved victory over evil, Richard Pearl?
Of course, we can't end evil in the sense that there are evil individuals. What we can do, and what we lay out a course of action for doing, is to contain the ability of those who would perpetrate evil acts, and we certainly regard mass murder as an evil act, constrain their ability to do that by depriving them of sanctuary, going after those governments that harbor and support them, by protecting our borders better, by making sure that people who come to this country come here and are properly identified and remain only as long as they're permitted to remain and only for the purpose that they apply to come in the first place.
But
Simple, is there practical measures?
But is there a perspective in here that while you're looking out into the world and tracking evil, also keeps track of perhaps shortcomings here at home? I mean, it is all in the end a kind of related world, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what that means. If the implication there is that imperfections in our own society somehow are the source or the cause of people.
Not necessarily the source of the cause, but is all the evil out there?
No, of course all the evil isn't out there. We're talking about a very specific evil. We're talking about people who think nothing about killing large numbers of people in order to realize an ambition, a vision, an ideology, if you like. And that ambition, that vision, is the remaking of the world in their Islamic image. It's very much like the ideological battles of the past with fascism, Nazism, communism. And now you have a radical vision for remaking the world in which all of us infidels are forced to adopt Islamic law.
David Frum, let me ask you, in the conclusion of the book, you and Richard Pearl write, you say, a world at peace, a world governed by law, a world in which all peoples are free to find their own destinies, that dream has not yet come true. It will not come true soon. But if it ever does come true, it will be brought into being by American armed might and defended by American might. What about the power of ideas itself? Is it really the case that democracy can be cultivated around the world by American armed might?
Well, it certainly is true that democracy has historically been protected by American armed might. If that might had been a little bit less mighty, that democracy would have been extinguished, what, in 1861 or 1862? I mean, it's simply a historical fact that American military power has been the guarantee up till of the amazing spread of democracy up until this point. And as we look ahead into the future of mankind, you say, well, how is it that this amazing idea, which is very powerful, is going to spread? You know, one of the things,
and you say it has to be spread at gunpoint. It will be brought into
being. No, but it has to be defended.
If it ever does come true, it will be brought into being, your words, by American armed might.
Yes. These ideas, at the same time as they are powerful and attractive to many people, are frightening and menacing to others. That the American democratic idea does mean many changes for many societies, and they have resisted them. And that has been true since the beginning of the century, when Imperial Germany saw democracy as a profoundly threatening force and responded with power. And power has to be checked by power. And one of the tragedies of our time is there are many people, good people, idealistic people, who believe that against power, all you need is goodwill. And they have found the results of that. That is tragic again and again and again.
Richard Pearl, same question to you. What about the power of the idea itself? Democracy being brought into being by American armed might, that's not really the traditional American view of how to encourage democracy around the world. Of course, democracy has been defended, but brought into being at gunpoint.
Well, if you look at World War II, for example, I think it's clear that American armed might made the democracy possible, not only in Germany and Japan, which were defeated, but in those parts of Europe that were occupied and at risk. And the point here is not that American armed might can establish democracy, but it may be necessary to open the door to democracy. Take Iraq, for example. There was no chance at all for democracy in Iraq while Saddam Hussein was there. Anyone with a democratic idea was likely to have his tongue cut out if he gave expression to it, or to die a painful death if he tried to organize to bring democracy about. So American armed might has opened the door to democracy in Iraq. It can't establish it, but it can make it possible and it can protect it.
And globally, you say the dream will not come true soon. How many years of American armed might bringing democracy into being around the world?
However long it takes. There's a practical self-interest in democracy. Democracies do not start aggressive wars. And if we want to be free from aggressive war, the best thing we can do is propagate democracy.
Well, I have to say, it, at the same time, it does sound like an aggressive plan to you, though I understand the end you're describing it, that aggression in the interest of. Interesting hour. Richard Pearl and David Frum, thank you both for joining us tonight.
All the best.
Thank you.
Richard Pearl, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan Administration, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and David Frum, former Special Assistant and speechwriter for President Bush, also a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.